Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. Annie here. We've got a full house. G'day, you guys.
Good morning.
In true amateur style, you moved the mics so that everyone could hear them.
Yeah, it's a sign. It's a sign how long we've been away.
That's exactly right.
I had a bit of trouble getting up this morning at 6 a.m. It's been too long. I've had a practice.
Yeah, yeah. We have to slap your face. Get away. Wake up.
And the weather didn't help, right, Annie? How was what's the forecast for today?
Oh, I don't know. There was a bit of spitty rain, but not much. And so I was just chugging along, hardly anybody there. But I'll tell you something, a bit of news. Yesterday when I was riding past Crown, there was police tape right across, and I was, I was thinking, oh no, another one getting in my way. And I realised, oh, something's probably actually happened. And there were two camera people from news outfits staring the building down. And I said, oh, what's going on? And apparently some kids burnt one of the restaurant-y things along Crown. And then someone told me that there's been a rash of burnings of eateries. Maybe this is a deeply critical eater out there.
Feeling particularly slighted by some meals that he's been served.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, and I thought it was funny because they said kids. And I'm thinking, oh, we're going to start. Is this going to be the next
great moral panic?
The great moral panic. And I said, okay, all right, see ya, and went away. And by the time I got back, it was all gone. It was erased. It didn't happen.
It's insurance paid for everything. Didn't hear about it in the news.
Oh well, maybe it did because I didn't watch the news.
I've been following the news this week. Yeah. To prepare to come back.
Okay, and what's happened?
I haven't come across it, so...
Oh, so it wasn't there.
A 3CR scoop. Yeah, I'm sure it was reported somewhere.
Oh, I'm sure it was. I mean, they had two of these freelancers. They don't even pay for them these days. They obviously offer them the footage, and if it gets passes some muster, then they buy it.
It's hard to feel sorry for journalists these days, but... It's a tough life.
Unless you work in Gaza and you work for Al Jazeera. And
that's true. That's a terrible thing for me to say while I'm sitting here in a community radio building. Obviously, journalists across the world do amazing work.
Mainstream journalists. Yes. Corporate journalists.
Lots of brave journalists.
So what's some of the data that you've corralled for us this morning?
One of the most exciting pieces of news for me this week was the kind of landmark ruling against a teenage boy in Adelaide who's become the first person to be charged under new laws that criminalise deepfake pornography.
Oh, interesting.
So this is something that, especially in schools, has become incredibly obvious as an emerging problem.
For wildfire.
New frontier of women being
abused.
Abused and having our bodies mistreated. But, yeah, it's interesting. He was charged with two counts of creating or altering sexual material without consent. And he's going to be returning to court in South Australia for a hearing next month. But that's a pretty big precedent to be setting around all of this emerging technology and how vulnerable it makes all women to being sexually exploited, often without their knowledge. There have been a few public cases also just reported on in the media of people finding out that their close friends, quote-unquote friends, have been producing lots and lots of deep fake porn content and circulating it on the internet and things like that. So it's not a small issue, and I think it's pretty heartening that there's been a precedent set that there are going to be consequences.
Well, that's interesting. It certainly is interesting. It's a Pandora's box, literally.
And another update in the world of Australian law. Annie, I'm going to give you the honour of talking about this because you're very excited.
I'm quite excited. Defeat of Min's anti-protest laws, a victory for the Palestine movement and democracy. Or as I like to say, Min's anti-protest laws bites the dust. Stop the War on Palestine spokesperson Adam Alderpour says Min's attack on the democratic rights of the people of New South Wales has failed and he stands condemned. He must resign immediately.
And it was the third time a law put forward by the Min's government affecting protest rights has been struck down by the Supreme Court. So this is becoming an emerging trend of trying to insert themselves in the landscape of civil rights, completely at odds with our basic kind of constitutional entitlement to showing up when we want to about the issues we care about. And I think it's also, I think, worth pointing out that even in the short period of time that these laws were in effect, they were having a real impact on, and they're still having an impact on, the way that people are able to show up politically.
It's pretty extraordinary that the Min's police force have been doing dawn raids on people who were...
attended the Herzog rally.
Well, and they were actually... It was a police riot. It wasn't a demonstrator's riot.
No, and it was these laws that have just been overturned that were responsible for the Min's government saying to the police, you have essentially the go-ahead to come and break up this protest, essentially giving them a full...
But it didn't stop them. They just continued after the event.
Yeah, I was watching mainstream media that shall remain unnamed, but they were saying they were twisting themselves into a pretzel to say protesting, pro-democracy protesters win in the Constitutional Court. I don't know. They were terribly confused on how to report on the story.
Yeah, right.
But we're not.
We're not. No. We're happy.
I'm zooming out a bit. I'll bring some updates from what's happening in West Asia, just for everyone that wants to remain updated as the situation just continues to change. Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi declared that the Strait of Hormuz, in line with the ceasefire that was just announced in Lebanon, will be completely open for the remaining period of the ceasefire. In a post on X, Araghchi specified that the strait will be open on the coordinated route, referring to the part that runs near Iran's coast. President Donald Trump responded by thanking Iran for opening the, quote, Strait of Iran in a post on Truth Social. Incredibly large games going on here. Shortly after, Trump added that the naval blockade will remain in full force and effect as it pertains to Iran until ongoing negotiations are complete. This process should go very quickly in that most of the points are already negotiated.
Someone put in a really interesting analysis of the so-called peace treaty. You know that the Americans sent J.D. Vance, who took his wife, to Pakistan to the peace talks, while the Iranians went in a plane that had 168 seats reserved with the pictures of all the children that were killed in that first attack. And a considerable group of people in the negotiating team. So J.D. Vance, the Americans, how serious are the Americans in when they
actually... Well, I mean, Donald Trump was at the UFC while this was all happening.
Yeah. Bizarre.
I think it also reflects the fragility of these ceasefires. Obviously, for the last year we've
been... Is it a cease or is it a fire?
That sounded a bit like slam poetry, I think. But anyway, we've obviously been reporting for the last year on the constant kind of commitments to ceasefires by Israel that are immediately undermined by them continuing to shell people or shell communities. But in particular, this ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon is kind of designed to not be permanent.
No, I think
permanent.
That's fire.
Yes, yes. So it's in place for 10 days to provide a bit of background information to the listeners. But interestingly, Mr. Netanyahu has been incredibly explicit about the fact that it's a temporary ceasefire. And their key demand to make it permanent, quote unquote, is to demand that Hezbollah is dismantled. But they also have stated that they have no plans to withdraw forces from southern Lebanon during any ceasefire, which, you know, kind of makes it difficult to comprehend how this could be interpreted as a good faith ceasefire if you're continuing to occupy territory.
Now, it's interesting because yesterday, if you wanted to catch up with a very good interview on Green Left Radio's breakfast show, they did a really interesting interview with a young Iranian, and they actually asked her about the role of Hezbollah, and she said that Hezbollah exists because the government has been unable to protect their people, that's its role, that's what Hezbollah is for.
And it's a pretty common historical story, and obviously present day story. It's really similar to the origins of the IRA. The provisional IRA's origin was essentially because of communities being brutalized and there being no state led protection for those communities. So communities take these matters into their own hands, and that looks like what we tend to define as terrorism.
Yeah, well. Yeah, focusing on the existence or non-existence of Hezbollah on the part of the Israeli occupying and aggressive army is really just mealy-mouth words, isn't it? When it comes to diplomacy, in inverted commas.
But it makes the lines between who's allowed to use force and violence,
yes,
who's supposed to put up with it, incredibly clear.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's like shackling people and saying, just sit there so that we can shoot you. Effectively.
And there's this kind of incredible, I mean, even in the reporting from the ABC, you have this incredibly audacious kind of normalization of Israel very directly and overtly committing to occupying other states' territory.
Yeah, it's theft. It's called theft.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the idea that these populations, it's inappropriate for them to use force, but it's completely appropriate for Israel to protect its security interests with force.
Well, it actually if you want to look at the analysis of it, really, it's they're struggling with the goodies and the baddies. They're struggling. You've got some news about Sudan?
I've got some news about Sudan. Sorry, I thought you were talking to Toby.
No.
I do have some news. I should compose myself before we talk about this part of the news because it's incredibly sad and the situation is only getting worse. But Sudan is entering its fourth year of war, and the International Red Cross has just put out a report with a bit of an overview of what damage has been done so far. The number of missing persons cases recorded by the International Red Cross has reached over 11,000, with an increase of more than 40% in the past year alone. More than 11 million people have been displaced, some of these people repeatedly being displaced by shifting front lines. Of these people, 4 million have fled the country entirely, seeking safety abroad. Between 70% and 80% of healthcare infrastructure in Sudan's conflict areas is non-operational or critically under-resourced. Nearly 70% of the population rely on agriculture and livestock, which have been severely disrupted. This, combined with the loss of assets and repeated displacement, has placed massive pressure on people's ability to cope and rebuild their lives. Daniel O'Malley, who's the head of the ICRC in Sudan, commented that, quote, "The suffering caused by the war has reached new heights of agony for civilians, not least due to its impact on essential infrastructure, markets, hospitals, water treatment facilities, and energy production plants. We see this in Darfur, the Kordofan, the White Nile, Blue Nile, Khartoum, and the Northern State. The whole country has at some point been affected by indiscriminate attacks."
And of course, this is a resources war. And remember that it's a proxy war that the United Arab Emirates are financing, it would appear.
The other bit of conflict in the Middle East that I'd like to touch on was what's been going on in Syria, because it's been reported, the American government hasn't confirmed this, but it's been reported by Middle Eastern Eye that America has finally finished its removal from Syria. And
withdrawn. They yes. like to use that word. All these nice little words. They packed their bags and they left.
Yes, with all of the kind of implications that are expected to come of it. But it's also been interesting following that situation, because Syria is another example of Israel's ambitions to create more territory for itself. And Netanyahu has committed to maintaining troops in Syria. So that's another bit of another hot spot to be paying attention to, Golan Heights. They are refusing to remove troops despite what's been going on.
It'd be interesting to know if they're overextending themselves, if they could potentially be overextending themselves, and if the sheer physical weight of the expenditure of the ordnance by these aggressive states, the US and Israel, will actually reach some sort of point where they can't actually sustain this aggression.
I think I've heard a pretty compelling argument that one of the reasons for the timing of America getting involved in Iran, the whole war itself, is because there's this limited window of time where America is going to have the global influence and military force and economic force required for Israel to make these gains in territory and hold on to them. So I guess I'm not an expert, so I wouldn't want to presume to know what's going to happen in the next 10 years of a very complex conflict.
If there's another 10 years.
But I think that it will depend on how supported they can be by American influence, wealth and force.
Did you guys have anything on the Viva fire?
Yeah,
I'd just be interested to hear about it, because I haven't been really following that story.
I do have something on the Viva file. It was sent out by Friends of the Earth, Stan, Anna and Ari from the Energy Justice Collective. The fire is the latest in a string of failures at the facility. Since Viva took over operations in 2014, workers have been hospitalised after exposure to hydrochloric acid, oil has spilt from poorly maintained pipes, and loud explosions in gas lines have shaken residents in North Geelong. In 2021, a toxic spill from the refinery released a cocktail of chemicals into Corio Bay, at many times the legal limit. The April 16th fire is further evidence of Viva's poor environmental and safety track record and should be grounds for a review of their recent approval for expanding their operations by building a floating gas import terminal. The Viva Energy Terminal, which supplies 50% of Victoria's fuel, has now added to Victorians' pain during a cost of living crisis, which has been exacerbated by war in the Middle East. Now is not the time to be approving further unstable fuel supplies and enlarging the fortunes of careless operators. Now is the time to invest in helping Victorians get off gas through fast and fair electrification to provide stability to our energy market. The fossil fuel supply chain is inherently dangerous, unstable and expensive. They have demands. What happens when the next fire burns on the proposed floating terminal, isolated from emergency services? What happens when the next undetected spill poisons Ramsar-listed wetland? What happens to the community when the next chemical catastrophe renders their coastline toxic, or the next inferno poisons their air? Viva Energy has demonstrated themselves to be incapable of caring for the environment, their workers and the community. And they call for the end of this notion that they should be running a floating gas hub in Corio Bay. But I heard on the grapevine that the issue with the Viva site with the explosion was actually to do with increasing the amount of flow through to deal with the fuel shortage, and because of the lack of high level maintenance, it was an inevitability.
The other thing I really wanted to squeeze in before we move on is the Commissioner for Indigenous Children's response to the horrific video that was circling this week of a 13-year-old being brutalised by an off-duty police officer. The Commissioner commented that the footage, which showed a child being restrained on the floor of a train before being thrown onto a seat, causing her to hit her head on a window, was, quote, deeply disturbing and unsettling to watch. The Commissioner, as a result, has called on the Western Australian Police to immediately conduct an investigation into this matter, describing the event as, quote, a representation of the violence that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children and young people face every day.
Ciao a tutte e tutti. Ci vediamo. See you.
At Democritus.
583 High Street, Northcote.
To celebrate the 25th of April.
La Festa della Liberazione.
With talks from Il Toscano, as well as interventi dalla file.
Pasta, pizza.
Proiezione del film.
Well, we can't say it all in Italian.
No.
We'll be showing Women of the Resistance, a film by
Liliana Cavani,
showing women's role in the resistance movement in Italy.
And then stay on after for live music and DJs to celebrate the Day of Liberation, Young Pesto's debut, and local DJs from the Italian community.
Pasta, danza e antifascismo.
Come down from 1 p.m.
Stay antifascist.
We're going to go on Solidarity Breakfast to the Lebanese, the vigil for Lebanon that was held on the 15th of March, April. We're in April. Wake up. 15th of April in Sydney. And, of course, it was supplied by our wonderful reporter, Vivian Langford.
This is Vivian Langford reporting from Sydney. It's a beautiful autumnal evening and Town Hall Square is filled with candles and Lebanese flags. Operation Eternal Darkness is the name of the April attack, which has horrified the world with its cruelty. People are weeping tonight. Many of the Palestinians who have been peacefully demonstrating for 2.5 years are also here in solidarity, and their people are weeping too. But as the Chinese say, it's better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. Towards the end, people were invited from the crowd, and you will hear a young man called Mohammed Abbas, a woman called Liz Jones, and a moving young woman called Hannah, speaking about her father called Ziad and a beekeeper who was murdered by a drone last week called Maruf.
I really believe, you know, when people gather together like this in solidarity and unity, that there's something that happens, the energy that's created between us. It's powerful. And if the people who we're commemorating today, who we're thinking of today, could feel this, I think it would bring some solace to their hearts. So we are on the other side of the world, but we do want the people of Lebanon to hear us. We're going to ask a couple of people who are gathered here today if they want to share a few words, but and it's just a reminder, it's not a call to political action. It's just a message from one heart to the heart of Lebanon.
My name is Mohammed Abbas. I come from the southern part of Lebanon in a village called Aitarun. My village borders the Israeli occupation, and for years, going back even before October 7 and just the recent murders that a lot of Israelis have committed over the past few weeks. This is a situation that dates back for years, even towards my mother's time back there, where she stood and lived in the village for a long time. And so did I. And over a few years, I had the opportunity in 2019 to come back to Australia, and a part of me wishes I never left, because I'll always feel this guilt for leaving my family and friends in the south and in Lebanon. Words are escaping me. My heart and goes to all families who have lost a young one in Lebanon, and it really warms my heart to finally see such large groups stand together after such a long time. My prayers go to all the families, to all my friends in Lebanon. Thank you very much.
Hi everyone, I'm Liz Deep-Jones. I'm Lebanese-Australian. My parents were born in North Lebanon. Unfortunately, they're not with us anymore. And I'm kind of glad they can't see this heartache and what's happening in our beautiful Lebanon. And shukran to everyone here tonight. Thank you for coming to bring love, peace and light in solidarity. I just recently wrote this poem because I needed to express my frustration, my anger towards what is happening in our Lebanon, the illegal Israeli invasion, and the continuous war crimes that they keep implementing with impunity. This poem I wrote is called Ya Habibi. Ya Habibi, your land, your home, your birth, your love, your heart, your soul, your family makes you whole. The beat of the cedar tree that flows through your veins stays with you forever till your dying days. She made you strong, resilient, so hospitable to all. The olive, za'atar, the kibbeh, hummus and tabbouleh keeps the culture alive. For it's the essence of the Lebanese, Ya Habibi, Ya Habibi, that sets us apart from the rest. We laugh, we cry, we love with all our might, for it's the will of the Lebanese that will never give up our plight. Whether on the land of the cedar tree or living elsewhere, our blood bleeds Lebanon. We will always care, for we are a people who stand together strong, even when those evil forces continue to do us wrong. This is our land, our heart, our rich culture. You'll never kill. Like the white dove of peace, we'll always fly high, pure with our love for Lebanon, cause Ya Habibi will never die. From generation to generation, we'll always keep that spirit, which is the love of life and love of Lebanon. A sovereign nation where the mountains fill your lungs and the sea lets you float to your heart's content. It's a land of great beauty and history we'll never forget. For my parents' love emerged from this great country to give us a firm foundation for a life so full. You'll need no more than this spirit of Lebanon, which fuels your passion, your life, your heart till the end. You see, Ya Habibi, we are Lebanon, and no matter what you throw at us, we will rise to the greatest heights in the name and legacy of our elders, which bleed red, white and green, proudly expressing our culture of resilience, strength and immortality. Ya Habibi, Ya Habibi, we are love, we are life. We are here forever in solidarity. Ya Habibi. Thank you. Shukran kullun. Hamdulillahikun. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. My name is Hannah. My mother is from a village in the south called Bint Jbel. It's 4 kilometers from the border with Israel. My father is from Beirut. After the news of a beekeeper named Maru Fremal, who was killed by an Israeli drone attack in the south. My dad's name is Ziad. He was born in Lebanon and moved to Australia with his family in 1985. He's kept an incredible array of hobbies over his life, but for a while, my dad kept bees. Maruf Ramal was a beekeeper in southern Lebanon. He sat on the board of the Beekeepers Union and he sourced bee strains for most of the apiaries in the region. Last week, Maruf was killed by the occupation in a drone strike. Every Palestinian and Lebanese person knows the feeling of seeing yourself and your family and every person who was murdered, every person who was injured, and every displaced person. You see a child crying that looks like your sibling. You see a hostage who bears the same name as your mother. You see a martyr who has features that are eerily similar to your own. Maruf's murder haunts me, and it reminds me of my dad's time as a beekeeper. I learnt a lot. I learnt that worker bees are all female, that they work in perfect synchrony their whole lives and generate only about a 1/12 of a teaspoon each. I learnt that bees communicate by dancing. They have one of the most finely tuned internal compasses and navigation systems on the planet. But mostly, I learnt about beekeepers themselves. I know that beekeeping takes patience, which Maruf doubtlessly had in bounds. I know that maintaining a hive takes a careful, particular eye for the perfect queen, and nearly every single apiary in the south had queen bee strains that were chosen by Maruf. I remember my dad explaining how each queen had a distinct personality and a temperament that could be passed on to every single bee. I know that beekeepers are generous. My dad gifted hundreds of kilos of honey to every single family member and friend. How many people enjoyed Maruf's honey? How many people enjoyed Maruf's generosity? I can't help but cry at the thought of these two Lebanese men that never met, that never will, who shared a homeland and a love for the small creatures of this world. I can picture my dad opening his hands at the dinner table to reveal a bee, much to my mum's alarm, and I imagine Maruf joyfully doing the same. And more than anything, I am tortured by the possibility that Maruf heard the buzzing of the drone that struck him down and was reminded of the buzz of a bee. The veil that separates my dad and Maruf, two beekeepers on opposite sides of the world, is made only of chance. The same is true for every Lebanese person in the diaspora. For me, Maruf's death hits particularly close to home because I know that he cared for the environment as only an indigenous person can. I know he spoke for his fellow workers as a union representative, and he tended quietly to the miraculous little creatures who themselves tend to our earth. Arab men, when they are martyred, aren't afforded the privilege of empathy or grief. Instead, they are falsely accused and scrutinized. Please take a moment for Maruf. Please take a moment for every one of our martyrs and remember that they are not just numbers. They are people with inner universes that are just as rich as yours, with interests and hobbies and passion. And for Maruf, a love of the bees.
And we'll leave the vigil for Lebanon that was collected by Vivian Langford. Very soulful music that was performed at the time. And we're going to move towards the Sorrento Writers Festival, which is running from next Thursday right through to Sunday. We've got on the line Henry Reynolds, historian, who is going to be part of a session on Friday the 24th of April, Australian History, Reframing the Past, Realising the Future. Good morning, Henry.
Oh, good morning.
Yeah, and, oh, we're, you know, pretty happy to be talking to you about this. You have been instrumental in changing the way European Australians understand the history of this place. Can you tell us a little bit about what you think are key important elements to this discussion?
Yeah, well, I mean, the main area that I became involved in was the place of Indigenous Australians and the First Nations, both Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders, because I moved when I was a very young academic to Townsville, North Queensland, where obviously you were in daily contact with Indigenous people, and you developed close friendships and an outer circle of people you knew, and then lots of people you just came across as you do in any social situation. So not only was I living there, but I was teaching the students, and obviously mainly the local white kids. I was teaching Australian history. And so you bring those two things together, and I realised that Australian history, at that point, had almost nothing to say about the Aborigines. They'd virtually been written out of the story. So that was the beginning, and I persisted with that for a long, long time. I mean, my first major book, The Other Side of the Frontier, that's over 40 years ago now, and so it's been a very, very long crusade, I suppose, that I engaged on, not so much because who I was, but where I was. And that obviously has had a dramatic impact over the long term on Australian history generally.
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, I was brought up in a country town in Victoria, and of course Victoria, because of its temperate climate, was part of the destruction almost immediately of part of the frontier wars. But I can remember myself feeling the deafening silence around Indigenous role in the country, because there's a settlement there called Framlingham. So So I went on a journey of my own on this, hardly not fighting at the same level as you, but in a certain personal consciousness. But what I find a bit odd is that it's one generation of people that have finally woken up to the horror on the European side.
Yeah. Well, the odd thing about it was that if you are doing historical research, you realise that in the 19th century, people had no doubt about what was happening and the violence. The debate wasn't, is there a lot of violence? The debate was a matter of, is it necessary? Is this an inevitable consequence of colonisation? It was the morality, not the existence of conflict and fighting. And by the century, by the 1880s, there was a very, no literate Australian person, Australian born or immigrant, no literate person could not be aware, because there was a, particularly, Queensland was the standout state in a colony in a way. And the major newspaper, the weekly called The Queenslander, for 6 months, had an ongoing campaign to talk about the conflict in a series of many, many editorials, a great number of people writing in, the whole series called The Way We Civilize, and this was then published as an important pamphlet. So, No one in that debate said, oh, no, you're wrong. It's all been peaceful. As I say, it was a debate about different things. Now, what happened between then, sort of, say, the centenary of colonisation, 1888, and into the 20th century and federation and, you know, the establishment of the Australian state, was that gradually all this was left behind. And so when I came to teach Australian history, I mean, the major book that was being used all over Australia for senior schools and universities, it only had two mentions of the Aborigines, and they were just said in passing. It's astonishing. They had been written out of the history in a generation. Now, that meant that the people that I, you know, that I grew up with, and particularly when I was teaching, they'd been, you know, up to two generations of people who'd been told, had learnt a history which had virtually left the Aborigines out of the story. And that, you know, and people were inclined to learn things, you know, when they're young and going to school and in their teenage years. They learn things then that they keep with them the rest of their life. So I realised that I was, in a way, I was battling against that two generations of neglect and ignoring and you know, simply not talking about violence or the frontier.
I'm a history student at uni, Henry, so I feel a bit starstruck talking to you because you're the person that we get kind of given readings from. But the thing that when I'm listening to what you're talking about, it brings up for me a discussion that we've had in some of my units about the shift in historical study around who was the subject of study and who we write histories for. And I think the period of time that you were starting out was a really pivotal moment for focus in history, moving away from histories of essentially European colonies and great wars and great historical figures to creating a more diverse representation of who's being studied, who's being looked at, and whose stories are being told. I'd really love to know how your attempts to create a more accurate picture of Australian history were received by your peers and your community.
Badly.
Obviously, there's the Keith Windschuttle debacle, but in your kind of day-to-day life, how receptive were people to this information?
Well, very, very mixed, obviously. Very mixed. I mean, let's start with the profession. Now, when I began, as I said, there was, you know, I got no encouragement from the generation. You know, I was a very young, and they, you know, they were chaps in their 50s and 60s, the leaders of the profession. And I got very little encouragement from them. But on the other hand, from a very early stage, I got, I got a whole year after year, I got big research grants from the Australian Research Council, which enabled me to go all over Australia. I mean, every part of Australia, every library and archive over a 10-year period, and that was all paid for by research grants. So I can't say I wasn't encouraged, because in that sense, I was.
Well, that's really interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's part of that deeply uncomfortable sense that we've all got, I mean, the country really needed to wake up.
The most interesting story is with what happened with the other side of the frontier. Now, I'd spent 10 years from 1970 to 1980, basically, going all over Australia. I literally wanted to find out if what I learnt about North Queensland was true all over Australia, because, you know, as far as I knew, And there wasn't much, you know, historical writing about it. So I had to go all around Australia looking and to see if the story I had learned about in the north of Queensland was replicated elsewhere. So, I did all that work. Now, I sat down, I had a three-month-long service leave, and I sat down, look, I've got all of this vast amount of paper, because it was all paper then. What am I going to do? It's time I sat down and wrote a book. And how would I do it? Would I say, well, on the one hand, this is what was happening to the First Nations. On the other hand, this is what the colonists were doing. And I suddenly thought, look, no, I really have to write a story, firstly, from the Aboriginal point of view, and then from the settlers. And I wasn't even sure that there was enough material because, you know, I've been collecting bits and pieces, you know, from all sorts of sources. And I sort of gathered all these bits of paper together and I realized that, yes, I could write a book called The Other Side of the Frontier. Now, I sent it off to the two leading publishers then, Australian publishers, that's Penguin Australia, and which was very active then, and Allen and Unwin. Now, Allen and Unwin wrote back and said, oh, yes, this is quite interesting, but we think there are numerous areas where, you know, you could put more work into it. But Penguin was the extraordinary one. They wrote back and said, well, we're very sorry, but we think there are already too many books about the Aborigines.
Wow.
So we published it ourselves, the History Department in Townsville, as a self-published book. And, of course, it took off.
An earthquake.
We got, you know, the History Department office became, largely booksellers, packaging and sending packets of books off. And, of course, Penguin realised their error and said, oh, quick, we'd love to publish. And so the first public, the best-known edition was the first Penguin edition. But that was after it had sort of been knocked back. So, a very odd history, actually.
Mm-hmm. And you've got another book coming out that you're going to be speaking about at the Sorrento Writers Festival coming up on the 24th of April, so it's coming up pretty soon. Did you want to talk to us a little bit about what you're exploring in this upcoming book, Looking from the North?
Yeah. Well, this is very much a result of, as I say, of living... We went to North Queensland. That's, my wife Margaret and I. She later became a senator for North Queensland. Most people went to North Queensland for a year or two and then came back south. This is still the case in many parts of North Queensland, of North Australia, particularly in Darwin. Rapid turnover of people. But we, for one reason or other, we stayed. We stayed for more than 30 years, and our children grew up there and we became really completely immersed in North Queensland. Now, that meant that, it also meant that my students, a lot of students who did, because I felt at the very start, I've got to put special weeks have got to be set aside for the history of North Queensland in particular, because if not, they will get the impression that nothing of national importance has ever happened in their part of Australia, because there was not much, it was just left out of most of the histories. So that meant that a lot of students, dozens of them then over the years did, honours and masters and PhDs about local history. And because our experience was that people say, oh, no, it's too regional, we won't publish that book, we published most of them ourselves. And we published something like 40 books, pretty extraordinary. But it did mean that we were building up this very, very large knowledge of the history of North Australia. And
it's fascinating that they should say something's too regional, because in actual fact, specific versus global, this is the whole nature of writing. I mean, it's ludicrous.
No, they'd say, look, this is a good book, but there's not much market, you know.
Yeah.
You know, all Australian publishing is, you know, commercial. And they just said, well, you know, we just don't think we could sell, you know, enough books about this remote part of Australia. So that was why we published the books ourselves. But anyway, it did mean that we began to build up a very, very large knowledge of North Australia. And, of course, eventually I came to realise that we weren't just sort of adding on to Australian history, you know, like putting on a new shed at the back of the house. We were finding that it really was a very distinctive and different story.
Yeah.
And so it really is this distinctive story about North Australia. And, even now, you see, people sort of don't quite realise that it's 45%, you know, north of Capricorn, it's 45% of the Australian landmass, but only 5% of the population. And so the history of the colonisation of the north is so utterly different. And in a way, it's the story of the failure of colonisation, unlike in the south, where the very, very soon the First Nations people were overwhelmed, as much as anything, just by numbers.
Yeah.
Whereas in the north, this never happened. And so, if you look at the north as it developed, its early period of colonisation, there were the Pacific Islanders who basically allowed the sugar industry to develop, because you had to have cheap labour or you couldn't compete with Fiji and Mauritius.
And so what you're really going on to is the underlying slavery of the economy of Australia.
Well, you see, of course slavery often kicked it off, but by the end of the period, this was a thing which the islanders chose to do. Many of them had come a second and a third time. And many of them stayed in Australia and became, settlers in their own right.
Yeah, I remember reading a story when I was a kid called Pastures of the Blue Crane, which was about people who were islanders in the cane fields. It was a novel.
Yeah. Well, as I say, they became, they became successful colonists themselves. But of course, they all got expelled. But anyway, that's another story. That's part of the story. Now, there's also a clear case where all the labour for the pastoral industry, which was absolutely critical right across the north, from the Pacific to the Indian Ocean, the great tropical savanna, open grassland. This was the northern pastoral industry, overwhelmingly the workforce for the local Aborigines, because there was no other alternative, and so they stayed on their country. They had to manage the white boss, but they stayed on their own country, and weren't pushed off because
they had some economic use.
Well, they weren't just the main labour, but they were so good at it. You know, in a very short space of time, the young people became, horse people of great skill. They knew the country. They could track animals. They knew everything. You know, they knew the country in a way that, a white manager and often one or two white workers simply couldn't. So they were absolutely critical right across the north. And then there were the Chinese who came into the north and became major players in the development. I mean, if you look at Cairns. Now, Cairns and the area around it was, at least a quarter and hire Chinese. And the Chinese weren't, you know, coolie labourers. They were highly well-educated. Many of them, you know, with capital. They bought in from Hong Kong and Singapore, and they developed the local industry. So then the same is true of the Japanese and the pearling industry. So the development of the North was a multicultural operation. And this is the critical thing was there were never enough white colonists. And the fundamental difference was that the British in the South provided 150,000 convict men and women, young people straight into the workforce, could be made to work anywhere, cheap labour, and this didn't happen. Now, if they put 150,000 young British and Irish men and women in the North, it may have been utterly different, but they didn't. I mean, by then, and the whole fundamental difference is that south of Capricorn, the colonisation was a British effort, of part of the British Empire. North of Capricorn, it was the colonisation by the Australian settlers themselves, by the government, you know, the self-government to come for Queensland and for South Australia and Northern Territory. And it was a colonial operation, not a British Empire operation.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it?
Well, it's
hugely different.
It's a fundamental difference, which you just, you know, and you wonder why ever didn't I think about this before?
Well, we have to finish because we've run out of time. But we could obviously talk to you forever. The Australian history, reframing the past, realizing the future. You're going to be sharing the stage with Rachel Perkins.
That's right.
And before you go, I think we better plug the brilliant Australian Wars program that I think you contributed to. Rachel hosts it. Great.
Yes.
It's a 3-part series that goes over the frontier wars. Would recommend.
That's right. That's why you guys have been paired, I guess.
Oh, yes. And, of course, we produced a book based on a series called The Australian Wars. So this came out at almost the same week as my book about the North.
Perfect timing.
Yeah.
And, of course, if anybody wants to hear this fantastic session, it's on the 24th. On Friday the 24th in Sorrento, where all the best people will obviously be from Thursday through to Sunday.
Okay, good.
Thank you very much for talking to us today, Henry Reynolds.
That's a pleasure. Okay, bye-bye.
A week solidarity, Bricky Team listener, when, thank goodness, thank the white God, and Yahweh, for caring business class party supremo and would-be big supremo Angus Tailing saving us from this Islamic heathen hordes invading our country and attacking our true blue Aussie values. Keep people who don't hold our true blue Aussie values from invading us. Bet the tyrannilious non-land, non-people wish they'd put a bet 238 years ago. Angus, we asked Angus, what are true blue Aussie values? They are respect for our way of life, our democratic way of life, our institutions, are going to work every day, that sort of thing. Yes, yes, the respect for your caring employer is an important value. That's why I am so annoyed at evil unions who have no respect for that value. Good point. And the big supermarkets, for instance, advertise that they offer great value. Is that what you mean by true blue Aussie values? That's certainly part of it. Yes, they are good examples of true blue Aussie values. Angus, as the caring business class party sinks to oblivion in the polls, many of your colleagues say the party must return to caring business class party values. Are they true blue Aussie values? Certainly, true blue Aussie would be a better place if all true blue Aussies adopted those values. But the socialists and, say, the Greens would say they have different values, even if with the socialists it's hard to find them. They are a threat to the values I'm talking about. They are anti-true blue Aussie values,
based on commie propaganda and environmental anti-progress nonsense. So are they the sort of people who should be deported? Certainly, I'd send them back to where they came from. But Angus, most of them came from here. That does raise a slight but not insurmountable problem. You didn't name who you had in mind when you talked about people who will not accept true blue Aussie values. It made it pretty hard to discern who you were talking about. Because I had no one in particular in mind when I talked about the Islamic heathen hordes. You did say you'd deport the 3,000 non-land, non-people Gazans who've come here fleeing the slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation. Absolutely. These heathen terrorists will never accept true blue Aussie values. They couldn't even accept our very, very close friend Zion's true blue Aussie values. You mean Zion values? Whatever. Clearly they only have themselves to blame. How's that? For being who they are, non-land, non-people, Islamic heathen terrorists, one of my two pet hates. What's the other one, Angus? Racists. Thank you, Angus. Pleasure. Oh, look, just before you go, have you noticed you share that appalling Hoon Son's no notion true blue Aussie values? No, that would be a pure coincidence. The toss in the tail award of the week to fossil energy minister Chris Bowen to Capital. No, that's a bit unfair. We all appreciate the fine balance Chris has struck between addressing climate change, if there is such a thing, and approving more and more coal and gas into the foreseeable future. But no, he has earned the award. For the minister so committed to reducing fossil pollution visited an oil refinery and said the fuel crisis meant climate reduction plans are not at the top of my to-do list. He has more important matters like ensuring the flow of fossils. Let's repeat that. The minister responsible for reducing fossil pollution says addressing climate change is not on the top of his to-do list. Oh yes, Chris, you've earned your toss in the tail award, which is on its way. And it's not like his policies aren't working. Why, in the past year, the pollution industry has reduced its emissions by a massive, wait for it, a massive 2%. Won't that make a difference? In Chris's favour, he is but obeying the orders of the great pollution behemoths who told the government addressing climate change, if there is, must take a back seat to bolstering their profits, Strait of Hormuz, fuel crisis and all that, which poor dears are under threat by a government thought bubble that it may impose a super-duper excess profits tax on the super-duper excess profits the gas behemoths are reaping. This, the True Blue Aussie Business Profits Council counseled on their behalf, would, anyone want to have a stab? Yes, spot on, would damage future investment and weaken True Blue Aussie's sovereign capability, whatever that last bit meant. Encouragingly, the polluters are supported by Pollution Resources Minister Madeleine Kinghead Mother Earth. Yes, Madeleine said a tax would hurt investment as she pointed out the great things the big polluters do for all of us. More big news for Mother Earth. One economist this week lauded China-based Yancoal's takeover bid for a huge Queensland coal mine, urging the government to approve it because it would guarantee coal, coal, coal for at least 25 years. Yet another contributor to the transition from itself, the slow, oh-so-slow transition. But a blot darker than the coal itself, the bloody evil unions, yet again mentioned last week how they're moving on to the long de-unionised Pilbara, causing apoplexy for the poor, caring employers. At INPEX, a giant LNG project, they're threatening strike action at the worst possible time, adding the poor, caring employer bemoaned further pressure on global gas supplies in a time of crisis. Why can't they time these things properly, or better still, refrain from irresponsible industrial action altogether? And a report this week that our 200 biggest polluters bought a record amount of carbon credit. That's a tree at the back of Bali or a ghost tree in a paddock out in the Mallee somewhere. Credits as they failed to meet Chris's safeguard mechanism guidelines, the biggest polluter, Chevron's Gorgon Island LNG project. Interesting, because if it was approved on the guarantee, it would stick its head in the sand and bury all that CO2, the 9 million tons real figure it released into the pristine atmosphere. Well, pristine, before Chevron got to it. Don't tell me carbon capture and storage, sequestration, burying your head in the sand, doesn't work. After all, the polluters swear by it, and the long-haired commie, greeny, wooden worker and iron anti-true blue Aussie environmentalists swear at it. And as fossils erupted in an inferno in Corio Bay, how heartless of the same long-haired commie greenies to suggest sun and wind pose no threat whatever, when we all know the sun is one big ball of fire and the wind exacerbates all those fires caused by the fossils. On such matters, remember before the last election, after the Environment Department said salmon farming in Macquarie Harbour was an environmental disaster, Big Supremo Anthony Albanese balanced votes for against votes against and said the department had no idea what it was talking about. What would the Environment Department know about the environment? And salmon farming was as safe as a nuclear power plant. Well, it was revealed this week those two supermarkets we referred to got together to ensure their sourcing salmon from Macquarie Harbour continues, their house brands. Although slogans like clean, green, environmentally responsible and finally responsibly sourced have disappeared off the labels. How dare critics accuse the duopoly of collusion? As Woolworth's Trillions pointed out, the sourcing of salmon from Tasmania is important in meeting our customers' needs. How do you know that? Well, people buy it. So you couldn't meet those needs by sourcing salmon from a non-polluting source. The answer lies in the cash register. Beside Anthony Albanese said it's absolutely safe, no environmental problems. Then why did you remove the green responsible source bits? Very strong advice from our legal department. And why did the labels not mention Macquarie Harbour? A very strong advice from our legal department. It also said it had undertaken a risk and impact assessment. And not sourcing from Macquarie Harbour would pose a serious risk and impact on our bottom line. Fair enough. Much more important than what's happening at the bottom of Macquarie Harbour. Profits might be secure, but we're not. Thus, our minister for being offensive and trained killing Richard Malls, the bad guys, he of the giant mind, announced billions more on the merchants of death. Obviously, those savage cuts wise, caring business class economists and practitioners know we have to make in the budget will have to come from somewhere else. Because being offensive is good for all of us, although, oh dear, we are still below the 3.5% spending on trained killing on the merchants of, but that other giant mind, Richard U.S. of the UN of the U.S. of the world counterpart Pete Hug Killstuff, ordered us to spend. We have no choice but to take our orders. And as Pete's commander-in-chief cures the world as the dear baby Jesus, well, Dr. Jesus, as the proverbial hit the fan, and any reasonable person could see he was a doctor and not the dear baby, fake news, Donald exploded. Indeed, let's be honest, mad as a hatter. Richard said our relationship with mad as a hatter Donald and Pete is still our most important alliance. Richard's so bright, such a giant mind, he probably still thinks Donald deserves the Nobel Peace Prize. And as the responsible corporate sector screams out for government spending cuts, just one example. The, quote, True Blue Aussie's fourth largest home builder, Japanese-based Nex, real name, announced a $180 million land spend on which it will build 900 homes and then called out for government relief for the development industry. Well, they spend nothing on public housing, so they might as well fill the coffers of the filthy rich. Finally, back where we started, Angus is saving us from the hordes, True Blue Aussie values. He must be spot on, because one of our most revered socialists, devoting every second to the working class, New South Wales Supremo Chris Minghee, said he agrees with Angus. But what a setback. His state's appeals court has overthrown his make protests illegal laws. Let's hope his gentle, protectors of the peace aren't shining their batons, sharpening their boots and playing with their paramilitary arsenal of weaponry for nothing. What's the appeals court got against socialism? Good morning.
Jolt Arts presents Le Scatterman, a recently divorced sound artist dad gorges on new lows in parenting, human engagement, and generally being crap. Part solo concert featuring piano, guitar, voice, and synthesizers, and part commedia dell'arte, Le Scatterman features unruly flashes of dark comedy and a twist of performance art. Delivered by Australia's recalcitrant sound artist, James Hullick. Jolted Art Space, April 9 to 18, Melbourne International Comedy Festival. Tickets at jolted.art. A 3CR supporter.
What if one meal could change someone's life? Host a feast for freedom this autumn at your home, workplace, or in your community, and cook delicious recipes shared by our hero cooks from Palestine and Sri Lanka. Bring people together over food and raise vital funds to support people seeking asylum. Register now and host your feast by the 30th of April at feastforfreedom.org.au. Feast for Freedom is an initiative of the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, a 3CR supporter.
And yeah, we're back on Solidarity Breakfast, and we've got Jordan Crook on the line from the Victorian National Parks Association. Hello, Jordan. How are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're actually there. the reason why we've got you here is because the Victorian government is basically, by stealth, I suppose, attacking the organisations that have been set up to protect environments or keep an eye on what's going on in the environment. Can you give my listeners some idea of what they're doing?
Yeah, definitely. Ever since the change in premiers, there's been quite a change in tone and actions by the state government. We're seeing big cuts to fisheries officers, so half of them got sacked. We've got a big, almost $100 million cut to Parks Victoria, who look after our national parks and protected areas. But they've also abolished two very important government institutions, the Marine and Coastal Council, as well as VEAC, which is the Victorian Environment Assessment Council. Both got abolished about a month ago.
And so this seems to be running alongside the announcements for seismic testing in the Otways, as well as extending the gas exploration off the coast of Victoria?
Yeah, it's at a time that we definitely need a Marine and Coastal Council to be that independent voice to government about what should and shouldn't happen along our coastline. They went ahead and cut it, which is even weirder because it was set up under the Andrews government. So it's essentially been set up and destroyed by the same government.
And the argument is that it's a cost-cutting measure, but they hardly cost anything.
Yeah, they cost next to nothing, really, compared to level crossings and the like. And the amount of good that they do for society well outweighs the investment made into them.
What are some of those goods? What difference does it make actually having robust environmental protection agencies?
Yeah, I guess the two bodies, the VEAC and the Marine and Coastal Council, give independent advice to government. So it takes decisions out of bureaucrats and made internally by ministers, and they're make evidence-based decisions and put that to government. So if it wasn't for VEAC, we wouldn't have most of the national parks that we have. But we know that if that was left up to politicians, they'd probably still be fiddling around trying to make a park that appeases everyone, including those who want to exploit and damage those areas.
I was doing a bit of research into some of the Victorian government's upcoming AI data centre projects and the Allen government was incredibly clear about the fact that potential investors didn't need to worry about any sort of environmental regulations. Victoria is going to be a really friendly state to investors. So it seems like across a few different policy positions, they've made it pretty clear that environmental regulation and protection isn't their priority. Why, particularly considering that we're in the middle of a climate crisis, is it not appropriate for our state government to make this such, I don't know, a
carte blanche, stupid policy stance?
And to make the environment such a peripheral issue when, as I said, we're in the middle of a climate crisis?
Yeah, it makes no sense at all. And, you know, the government's always going on about how, you know, Melbourne's the most livable city in the world and the like. It's only livable because of the natural environment that we're lucky enough to still have in Victoria. So those laws and regulations that look after environment, whether that's wildlife and habitat or clean air and fresh water, they're societal goods. Like they look after all of us that live in that environment. So it's
Let's look at some of this track record. One of the by getting rid of these bodies, what they're doing is trying to move it into the hands of the Commissioner for Environmental Sustainability. And so that you've got one person who's supposed to replace all the knowledge of scientists and others who are involved in the consultation process that were part of those VAC and VMCC. So they reckon that they can use one person to decide the fate of the environment in Australia, in Victoria.
Yeah, it's shocking. And the VAC, the Environment Assessment Council, they were experts in their field, and they got brought into the council when the government decided to do an assessment of public land. So we're really trying to switch off the voices of experts, unfortunately, when, like you said, we're in the middle of a climate and biodiversity crisis. We should be listening to experts more and more, not less.
The Allen government arbitrarily opened up the Snowy River and the Yurrunundra National Parks to deer hunting, and made dramatic cuts to the, as you said, the fisheries. But we've just received information about things like Mount Macedon community members being really angry about the destruction of snow gum forests because the Mount Macedon Memorial Cross Committee were pushing to cut down the snow gums to restore historical views of Melbourne from the Memorial Cross on the summit of the mountain. So what you're seeing is a political view or an ideological view set against the sustainability of the environment in Mount Macedon. Like, you know, knock down some snow gums so that you can get a better view of Melbourne. I mean, and then we get some information coming out of Gecko up in from Goongra about how the they want to do an enormous burn, a 34,000 hectare planned burn in the Snowy River National Park on its 10-day ignition schedule. Australia's leading fire ecologists and biodiversity researchers have signed an open letter calling on Environment Minister Stephen Dipinopoulos to immediately pause this burn. The science does not support it. The cumulative fire history of this landscape is devastating. More than 110 threatened species are at risk. So, I mean, this is what happens, isn't it? From your point of view, from the, you know, your watching brief as Victorian National Parks Association is that basically if you leave it in the hands of politicians, you're in big trouble.
Exactly. They're not, there's not many ecologist politicians out there, if any. yeah, the capitulation of the Allen government, not just to the destroys the environment, but also to the shooting lobby by letting deer shooters into national parks and a whole raft of other issues that they've capitulated to them has been really, really disturbing and weird.
And I think for me, part of the urgency of this issue is that once these things are gone, you can't have them back in the same way. Like, if you destroy the environment, of course, it's possible to restore and regenerate the environment, but it's never going to be the way that it was before if we don't value and preserve and protect these parts of, as you said before, our commonwealth, our common environmental goods. If we don't take care of them, we lose them.
Exactly, and that's a lot of people probably don't know, but the VAC, who's now been abolished in assessment back in 2016, and they found that Victoria is the most cleared state in Australia. Even though we're one of the smallest, over 70% of our native habitats and native vegetation is gone. It's under bitumen and paddocks and houses. So that last remaining 30% that we have left needs to be looked after and protected, not neglected as it currently is.
I mean, I know that your association is trying to raise awareness, have you been getting any responses from the public about this? I mean, on the ground in rural areas, because having lived in the bush, one of the things that struck me that a government could possibly actually lend its hand to would be the removal of noxious weeds. I mean, that's what a government's good for. But destroying our environment holus bolus like this by not even, ensuring that there is no oversight so that no information and data is collected is negligent. This government is acting in a negligent fashion.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very, very short-term thinking as well. Like you said, 1 or 2 years of not spraying weeds or removing feral animals, those numbers double and triple when they get out of hand and uncontrollable. So it's incredible short-term thinking that will have repercussions on not just environmental health but people's physical health as well. You've got feral deer and the like running around, getting out of control, running in front of cars, and it'll ruin our water quality and carbon storage and the like. So, like, we rely on the environment. We don't rely on but the car races at Albert Park and the like, which they love to fund.
And, you know, it's not just the Labor government in Victoria. The Liberals don't have any skin in the game, and the National Party are equally remiss when it comes to having any proper environmental policies.
Yeah, definitely. And it's the weirdest thing about the Victorian Parliament at the moment is that it seems there's not much difference between the Labor Party and the National Party.
Really bad, isn't it? It's not even much difference between the Labor and Liberal. Now it's gone even further. There's not any difference between Labor and National.
Yeah, and it's just, like, Labor has got a long history of good environmental things. Like, Joan Kerner protected a lot of the parks that we've got now. She protected 1.9 million hectares of national parks when she was in, like the Grampians and parts of the Dandenong Ranges and the like. But to just have a government in a Labor or so-called Labor government that's just doing all it can to go after the environment and environment protections rather than protecting it and looking after our shared backyard is just, it's mind-blowing and just weird.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. What would you call on people to do to push back from this?
Yeah, we've got a few email actions on the VMPA website, vmpa.org.au. There's one there on feral deer. There's a few there on loophole logging, like what's going on at Mount Macedon, and a few there on not cutting critical institutions. So there's still a few more on the chopping block. Hopefully they get off the chopping block. But yeah, there's plenty on the website, and there's we put out a bi-monthly magazine as well that's online for free that folks can check out and learn more and get in contact with their local MPs and their mates and, yeah, get together and help look after Victoria's environment.
Yeah, part of it is people being realising that it's actually happening. Like, you know, they can go on their camping journeys and then suddenly realise that there's no maintenance of the tracks. I mean, you know, it's pretty appalling.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's terrible. And it's those cuts are really starting to bite now, and you're starting to see the impacts in the parks. So, yeah.
Thanks for talking to us this morning, Jordan.
No worries. Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. It's pretty depressing, I reckon. No, the fight's on. Fancy doing that. I mean, the Allen government, slap across the face.
That's a great reminder. I think, particularly as a young person, I find it very, very stressful hearing about how mismanaged the environment is.
Yeah, and they could.
But there are things to be done.
There's
no time to be hopeless.
I mean, if you're going to be so, the Victorian government can't even employ fishery officers to protect the environment or people to clear the paths in national forests. I mean, really. Pathetic, absolutely pathetic. We've come to the end of the program.
And just make sure this Sunday you come to the Palestine protests at 1 p.m. at the State Library. Yesterday was Palestine Prisoners Day, and just a reminder that the genocide's still ongoing and to get out there on the streets.
Exactly. Coming up next is Asia Pacific Currents. Thanks for your company this morning. We're going to go out with this great song called Small Island, Big Fight. It's fantastic. I heard it last week and I thought, oh my God, this is a fantastic song. Sayonara.
About way before time, when Gilam created my island,
he sailed the seas on a strong sagar breeze
and created a song out of silence.
Two islands combined, this island of mine,
a paradise lost in the sea. Malo created the lore and the clan,
and the totem that belongs to me.
The creatures that fly,
the birds in the sky,
the fishes that dive on the reef.
My people, my blood, this island I love, my spirit, my soul, my belief. Warrior nations are gonna defend, respect the Meriam clan, understand?
Talk Moki Moki, Tete Moki Moki.
Small island, big fight, yeah. Ooh, 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 yeah. Ooh, 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 yeah. Small island, big fight, yeah. Ooh, 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 yeah. Ooh, 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 yeah.
My spirit, my soul, my island, my fight, my land, my right.
My clan, my straight up island way. The warriors fought in the sand and the sun, and I speak recognition today. 1981, a Meriam man lodged a claim to say. Mama and others and sisters and brothers and mothers would ignite the flame. The flame would burn, the world would learn. You can't take my island away.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.